Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. State and local lawmakers are reacting to concerns about the impact a proposed data center could have on electricity costs.
The authorities here are trying to learn from the experience of other places to protect Delawareans from any negative effect of data centers.
Contributor John Hurdle offers the latest on the debate over bringing a massive data center to Delaware. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about Delaware's plan to boost early childhood literacy. Arts Playlist explores the Milton Theater's expansion plans. And Enlighten Me explains how a Nemours neurologist's work could help develop therapies for autism, epilepsy, and Alzheimer's disease. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned in to a first date of mine. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Plans to build one of the largest data centers in the country near Delaware City in Newcastle County remains a front-burner issue, with state and county governments responding with efforts to pump the brakes on the project and put some guardrails in place to address concerns over the facility's potential impact. At the same time, the developer behind the plan is ramping up its efforts to make its case that the center will be a benefit to Delaware. This week, Delaware Public Media contributor John Hurdle revisits the battle over this project, known as Project Washington, to offer a snapshot of where things stand. And John joined me earlier this week to discuss what we know. So John, let's start with a quick refresher on this data center proposal. What is the developer envisioning here?
This would be a major industrial development. It will cover 6 million square feet of construction. That's on about 560 acres near Delaware City. It would be in two phases, the second of which would require a zoning change by Newcastle County. And crucially, this data center would use about 1.2 gigawatts of electric power. Now, to put that into some kind of context, that's bigger than some of the offshore wind farms that until recently were proposed off the Atlantic coast. And it is about half of what the whole of the state of Delaware used in 2024. So this would be a really big industrial development.
And the chief concern is that project's electrical needs that you just mentioned, that 1.2 gigawatt power demand. Critics say handling that demand will ultimately raise electric bills for residents who are already seeing high energy costs these days. The state has jumped in here with an initiative to blunt that possibility, asking the Public Service Commission to create a large load tariff for high demand users like data centers. Can you explain what this is, this tariff, and how it could help?
Large load tariffs are contracts between utilities and large energy users like data centers. And they're designed to ensure that higher costs are paid for by the users, not by smaller residential or commercial customers. And the other intention of these tariffs is to provide grid stability for the utilities. In other words, that there's such a huge demand placed on the grid by customers like data centers there are concerns that the reliability of electric supply to regular customers could actually be interrupted unless the infrastructure is enhanced. And of course, that requires financial investment.
So, John, there are a lot of people out there who would like to see a stronger response to the data center's electric use. One of them is specifically State Senator Stephanie Hansen. What is she suggesting in terms of dealing with the possibility of this much, much higher demand?
Well, first of all, we should say that Senator Hansen is the chair of something called the Energy Stakeholders Group, and that is a group of energy executives, environmentalists, consumer advocates that meet every 2 weeks and are the starting point for quite a number of bills that have gone through that have been submitted to the legislature on energy. So Senator Hansen's statements on this may indeed carry some weight. And what she wants is for this data center to generate all or most of the power that it uses. And she says that that without that, ratepayers in Delaware will inevitably face higher electric bills simply because there isn't enough to go around. Now, the flip side, if you like, of what Senator Hansen's proposing is if the new data center generated its own power, then it would have it be in common with Constellation Energy, which is the owner of one of the two power units at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania near Harrisburg. Now, so Constellation is going to, they're going to restart that unit in 2028, they say, and all of that power will be supplied to Microsoft for a new data center there. So that presumably is an example of what Senator Hansen is saying, that I mean, she's not saying that it needs to be nuclear power, but somehow she says that this new data center, because of its vast power needs, it really should generate its own.
And there is still a bill from State Representative Frank Burns that is out there that would or could work concurrently with the large load tariff. Tell us a little bit more about that. Remind us, what would it do if it passed?
What Senator Burns' bill would do is it would set this large load tariff for customers that use at least 30 megawatts of electricity. I mean, which of course is much less than is planned by Project Washington. And then it would require the Public Service Commission to issue an operating certificate based on that entity's effect on the economy, how the new facility would affect ratepayers, and whether that enterprise would affect the state's goals of driving down greenhouse gas emissions. And we should say also that that the Public Service Commission spokesman says that the Burns bill is actually similar to the goals which have been laid out by the PSC.
Another response, John, is coming from the county level, an ordinance sponsored by Dave Carter to create some guardrails for projects like this in a variety of areas. He has refined it since first introducing it. Can you talk a little bit about some of the areas that would address?
Yes, well, there's a laundry list of conditions that Councilman Carter's proposed ordinance would set, and they include setting a minimum setback of 1,000 feet for data centers for homes and schools. There should also be, he says, an 8-foot berm, which would shield homes from noise, the noise and the sight of these gigantic buildings. And there should be strict limits on noise and lighting. So essentially, what he's doing is drawing on the experience of data centers and the effect that they have on in some other parts of the country, notably Northern Virginia, where some of these concerns have been raised.
So, John, you have had an opportunity to talk with officials at Starwood. Let's start with the demand on the grid that they would create. What are they saying in response to those concerns that have been raised?
Well, they're saying that they will pay, or at least they will, quote, help to pay for infrastructure upgrades that are necessary in order to meet this huge energy demand that they're planning. They say that the grid needs upgrading anyway, and that the existence of projects like theirs will provide the demand, the future demand that the investors will need to see in order to pay for these infrastructure upgrades. So what they're saying is that these activities will improve conditions for regular ratepayers, will make the electric grid more resilient and more reliable. And we should also say that Starwood, they've refused to rule out any rate increase for regular ratepayers. But what they say is that they want to keep rates as low as possible, and that they do not foresee any long-term increase in rates for regular consumers. You know, you might see what Starwood has said about this so far as a matter of hedging their bets. I gave them ample opportunity to rule out a possible rate increase as a result of their demands on the grid, and they backed away from that.
John, what are they saying about other concerns raised, things like water use, environmental impact, things like that?
As far as water is concerned, they say they're going to use what's called a closed loop system, and that's for cooling, and that is designed to minimize the amount of water that's used by one of these giant centers. What they say is that they anticipate using 13.5 million gallons of water a year, which would be, is they say, typical, similar to a typical office building. They are also at pains to point out that about 40% of the site will be left as open space. And that's about twice of what is commonly used by other data centers around the country. And it's actually more than the Newcastle County requires. And then Starwood is also saying that there will be no disturbance to wetlands as a result of the construction of this center.
So having said all that, is it fair to say that, Starwood is largely okay with the guardrails that Newcastle County is pursuing, or are there some points of contention with that ordinance and even the large load tariff that PSC is pursuing?
Well, I think it is fair to say, I mean, according to what I heard from Starwood's lawyer the other day, that they are okay with Councilman Carter's proposed ordinance for the most part, but there are some things in there that they want to negotiate. That is the proposed, they include the proposed noise level and the proposed requirement that the company provide financial assurances for decommissioning, that the county does not want to be left with taxpayers footing the bill whenever the center closes down.
John, Starwood is also making a concerted effort to sell the economic upside to their plans and the upside it would provide perhaps to the state of Delaware. What is the case they're making?
Well, they're saying that this is going to be a huge economic boon to the state. Their figures include 3,500 construction jobs, 700 permanent jobs paying at least $100,000 a year, a total of $9.7 billion in economic impact, and $75 million a year in local taxes. Starwood says, all on the basis of an economic study that was done by a consultant.
Starwood, despite all of this, all these concerns, all these efforts to push back, appears to be pushing ahead. Is it fair to see that they see Delaware and specifically this Delaware City site as the right place for them, despite all this pushback they're getting?
Well, they do. I think one argument they make that in favor of this Delaware City site is that it has existing electrical infrastructure. There is a 55 kilovolt line already there to which the data center would connect. They say that, you know, they're part of an industrial zone, at least for the first phase of this project, and they have access to a high-skilled workforce and fiber connectivity. So what the CEO of Starwood says is that, this is a terrific place for data center development, and he says that the conditions are very, very favorable.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. You can find John's piece updating where things stand with the Project Washington Data Center proposal in Newcastle County right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with a look at Delaware's plan to boost early childhood literacy. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. In third grade, students transition from learning to read to reading to learn, but there's a problem in Delaware. Governor Matt Meyer declared a literacy emergency earlier this year after eighth grade reading assessments showed Delaware students with their lowest scores in almost three decades. Statewide assessments in earlier grades tell a similar story, with proficiency rates at a standstill. Delaware Secretary of Education Cindy Martin says literacy makes a world of difference for students' life outcomes, and that's why she and Governor Meyer have put together their early literacy plan. Earlier this week, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee sat down with Martin to talk about this $10 million effort to support teachers and students in the first state.
It is my 38th year in education, and much of my time before going into administration was as a teacher and a literacy specialist. So it's not just the plan for Delaware, it's my life's work of being involved in literacy and understanding what it takes to give students a fair shot with high quality instruction for them to be reading on grade level at third grade, but even more than that, being a literate person. And so as a kindergarten teacher, like I said, and a reading specialist for many years, and also led San Diego Unified School District for 8 years. And much of the work we did around literacy, especially early literacy, not only matters for the future of Delaware, but it just really matters for students' life outcomes. So when we talk about literacy, we're really talking about opportunity because if a child can't read by third grade, then every other subject becomes harder. And the idea of learning to read and then reading to learn really does matter because reading opens doors across all of the discipline areas, math, science, history, even art. So when I think about when we started the Meyer administration, Governor Meyer and I declared a literacy emergency, and we did it because this is at the heart of it about equity. Every child deserves a chance to learn and to graduate and to thrive, and they are not able to do that as well if they are not prepared with strong literacy instruction.
So I'm interested in starting with what kinds of efforts are going to be made in terms of adding support for educators, and what does that look like in this plan?
The kinds of supports that matter most are our teachers, tier one instruction. It's kind of a technical teacher word, but teachers know what that is. Tier two and tier three is when kids don't learn the first time, then you give additional support for reteaching or additional instruction or support or tutoring. But tier one is good first teaching, and that's where the support lives. We believe that we need strong daily reading lessons for every child in every classroom, training and support for our teachers so that they have the tools that they need in science of reading. The state has passed the science of reading legislation. This is important to implement. So putting in training and support for teachers through multiple avenues of instructional supports really matters. That's how you move the needle. And then we want to make sure that teachers have a team building approach so they can work collaboratively. And the kinds of supports teachers are getting, we have actual funding, direct to classroom funding, and we have the Bridge to Practice grants that are also about supporting the classroom work. And teachers are able to order up to $750 in classroom materials to support their literacy goals. And then we have the Bridge to Practice grants. We want more teacher training, more coaching, more innovative staffing models. And so, in all, it's over $10 million statewide to make sure teachers have what they need to really make sure kids are learning to read. It's really about just turning the really good ideas that we already have in Delaware that are sprinkled all across the state and putting even more power behind it with more training and more support for our teachers.
What projects might the Bridge to Practice grants fund?
It's time for Delaware to implement all of the things that we know work, especially for K-3 early literacy and reading instruction. And that's why we called it Bridge to Practice, that the science of reading and getting the high quality instructional materials matter. We've already passed laws for that too. We want to make sure every district has the materials that we know are vetted and are meeting our quality standards. But materials alone don't teach students. We want the high quality materials, but we want Bridge to Practice. We want skillful implementation and use of those tools. Just think of it really simple. If you go to Home Depot and buy the most expensive glass cutter or circular saw or some fancy toy or tool, you can't just go home and start using it. You got to know how to use it. And so it's in practice in relation to the actual students that you're serving and using ongoing formative assessments in the classroom to know what do students need, when do they need it. I've got this great tool, but how do I use these tools to move achievement for my students? And am I monitoring student growth on an ongoing basis? I'm not waiting for the end of the year SBAC results to come in and wonder if my new teaching practices worked. I'm actually using ongoing, teachers will call them ongoing formative assessments. These are assessments for learning, not assessments of learning. The end of the year test is you're assessing the learning of the year. It's the autopsy. It's the end of the year. Did they learn everything I wanted them to learn? And it's once the year's over. You want ongoing assessments.
And I read that this will also put 25 reading assist tutors into districts statewide. Can you talk a little bit about what that'll look like and also how you decide where the tutors go?
Equity means where there's greater need, you're going to make greater investment. It means where students get what they need when they need it in the way that they need it. And let's just be clear about it, that I want the best instruction, high quality, first tier one instruction in the classroom, teachers supported to do that. And while we're working on that, there are some students that need a double dose. They are two or three grade levels below in reading. And so to catch them up, to have students reading on grade level by third grade, they need double, maybe triple dose of reading. It's not just random acts of literacy and just throw a bunch of tutors here and there and hope it works. It's very strategic and it's based on results. It's based on data. It's based on being able to be honest and transparent with each other about where do we have the greatest need. The bad news and the good news is all kind of wrapped together is that we have a literacy emergency, but we do know what to do about it. If you're doing a healthcare interview and you're interviewing me and I was a pediatrician, there are pediatricians, sadly, that have to talk about childhood diseases and cancers that have no cures. And those are very hard conversations because you're talking about very difficult things for children that we don't have answers to. A child not reading at the earliest ages, we have answers for that. We understand what to do. Some children, it's more challenging for them to become a reading on grade level by third grade. If they enter kindergarten, never having seen a book before, low language levels in the home, not being exposed to literacy from 0 to 5, and they show up in kindergarten on the first day of school, and it's maybe the first time they held a book or had anyone read a story to them. I had those students when I was a kindergarten teacher. And in my classroom, 50% of my kids came from Section 8 housing that was across the street from my school. 50% of my kids in my kindergarten class came from highly educated homes, families that were doctors and university professors. And there was a stark difference in who was ready to become reading on grade level at the end of kindergarten from the time they walked in my classroom door till the end of the year. Getting them all onto grade level, I use different approaches for different kids that came in prepared differently. I can extrapolate that my kindergarten teacher experience to a large state like Delaware, a large system, well, a small state, but to a large, much larger than one classroom, and say, what does it take to make sure that all students are reading on grade level at the end of third grade? We have the knowledge. We know what it takes. And what I learned to do as a kindergarten teacher with 20 kids, I've then extrapolated out to leading a whole system and working at the national level and now at the state level. Our teachers know what to do. We have the support, we have the resources, we have the funding and the investment that goes behind the best practices to make sure that they are in every classroom in Delaware. And this is about supporting our educators to do what they love to do most, is getting every kid reading, getting every kid on grade level, but giving them the right supports to do that really matters.
Outside of educator supports, we mentioned reading assist tutors, but from the student's perspective, can you talk a little bit about how this plan will affect the average student's day, especially K-3?
Well, first of all, I would say to every student and parent that becoming literate, of course, the teacher is going to teach the kids how to read, the decoding, the encoding, phonemic awareness, phonics, like the really detailed aspects of learning how to become a reader. But what really matters for kids is falling in love with a book, having a favorite author. Does every child in Delaware have a library card? Are they using their library? Is there reading time at home? And no matter what language you speak, you can read in whatever language is your family's home language, tell stories to each other. And actually being able to have a favorite author, have a favorite book.
I'm also curious to turn the conversation toward funding. There have been several districts statewide who saw referendums fail this year. Can you talk a little bit about the looming question of long-term financial solutions and how this plan plays into that?
In my 38 years in education, I have to say funding does matter. I wish that it didn't. I wish that we could just say no matter what we're given, we're going to make sure all students are reading on grade level and all kids are proficient. And I have that experience from running a large urban district in California. San Diego Unified, the district where I was superintendent for 8 years, had 100,000 kids. Delaware has about 140,000 kids. We had about 200 schools. Delaware has about 200 schools. And I only bring that up to say that in my whole 8 years as superintendent, every single year, the budget that I had to present to my board for public vote was a budget that included cuts. Every year for 8 years, California was going through financial cuts, and that impacted the districts. And so it sounds like a really simple math problem. I had to learn to add while I subtracted. I had to add student achievement and increase the graduation rate in San Diego, which we did, increase the overall outcomes, which we did, while I was cutting the budget.
What kinds of changes do you expect to see statewide as this plan comes to fruition?
I mean, what's most important is that it's focused on the local needs. This is the reason why we're structuring it this way, is the answers don't come out of Dover and mandating what everybody must do. All of the right laws are in place. Now we need implementation. The superintendents know their districts best, and they know how far are they in their journey. If this is a continuum towards best practice, where are you on the journey? And some superintendents are going to say, you know, our weakest link right now is kindergarten. We need to put more supports in kindergarten, support and training. So we're going to do multiple release and student-centered coaching cycles to get more kindergarten training. Some superintendents are going to say this is really in second and third grade. So I can't wait to see the ideas they come up with. But I want to say it's more than test scores. This is about children with real names, real strengths, real dreams, real hopes for themselves and for their families.
Thanks to Delaware Education Secretary Cindy Martin and our Abigail Lee for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we learn about the Milton Theater's expansion plans. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The historic Milton Theater has been around for generations, serving as a movie theater, a firehouse, even a private residence. And for the last decade, it's been a source for live theater in the riverfront town. Now the Milton Theater is getting a facelift, with a focus on the theater's education programs, which serve some 4,000 students a year, according to the theater. On this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by Milton Theater Director Fred Munzer to discuss their expansion plans.
Tell me about the Milton Theater and the work that you do and kind of the history of the organization and the building.
Well, we've been at the theater now for 11 years. Prior to that, it has a 100-year history of being part of the town of Milton, Delaware. And the theater was originally built as a movie theater in the early 1900s. Been several things throughout the years. It was the fire hall. It was a car garage. There was a diner there. There were all kinds of things in the space. And then in the 60s, there was a 100-year storm that kind of took out a lot of the East Coast, where Hoboth was really affected by it. And the Milton Theater was also affected very badly by it. And it was shuttered for many years. In the early 2000s, then a nonprofit came in and started to renovate it. And then they were there for about 10 years, and then they kind of went belly up. And a private owner in the town bought the theater, had lived there with, he and his wife lived there and their children. And he just didn't want it to become anything but a theater. He didn't want somebody to buy it and make it something different. So he bought it at a sheriff's sale. And then we ended up meeting in 2014, and the rest is history. We opened up, we met in January and opened it that June with folding chairs and a prayer. And, you know, now 11 years later, we will do over 400 events to about 60,000 people this year.
A big part of what you do is educational programs for kids. Tell me about some of the educational programs that you offer.
Yeah, so one of the very first things we did was we brought an educational program from another project I was working on in Middletown, Delaware. We brought those kids down and they did some of the shows that they had been working on to get the community just interested. And then we started a Saturday morning theater program and had so many kids in it. It was really amazing. And then we just started adding to that. We started a Tuesday night education program. And now at this point in the game, we really are running on wait lists year round. In the summer, we do 4 summer camps each summer, 65 kids a day. And usually by January 1st, they are just about sold out, if not completely sold out, with a wait list of 20 kids waiting to get in. So as part of the capital campaign, which has now been running since 2017, and we rebuilt the balcony and put the balcony back in the theater was phase one of that. We decided that we really needed to significantly add to the education space. And so we're adding an education wing, which also involves a number of other things, upgrades and things like that to the facility. We are in the process of breaking ground now. We are building now and really going to be doing significant building over the next few weeks in the hopes that by summer we'll have this open and be able to offer more programs to more students.
I was prepping for our talk today, and the reach of that educational work is just so broad. It's huge, 4,000 students a year, 10,000 young audience members a year. And I wonder, you know, in a world of social media and screens of all size, what's the pitch to kids to say, hey, put the phone down and come act, come sing, come dance?
Yeah, it's fascinating to me because this has been my career my whole life. I've worked in the arts one way or another. And I really, as phones came on the scene, I was like, you know, what's this going to really mean? And I think it just shows the power of live art and how it impacts us in a way like nothing else does, whether it's a band, a comedian, you know, whatever it is, a musical, a play, it just really affects us in a very specific way. And we have never seen a decline. We've never seen a decline. But, you know, we're really encouraging them to pay attention to one another, to look at each other and have a relationship with one another. You know, I feel like just like sports, it's one of those things that the phone just doesn't belong there. You can't run around the sports field with a phone in your hand. You have to actually connect to the people you're doing that work with. And theater is the same way. It's really about connecting with other humans and then creating something together.
Speaking of participation, I wonder if you can talk for a moment about the importance of the educational programming that you provide, especially in light of seeing some pretty widely sweeping cuts to arts funding.
As far as the cuts go, and we certainly have felt them pretty dramatically. We had quite a bit of money coming to us to build this building. We're going to build the building. I will find another way. I just believe that, and people have given to help make up some of that gap, and we're asking people to continue to do that. So I've always had the philosophy that art should make its money from what it's doing. So for example, if it's a classroom, it should make its money from participation fees and scholarships and things like that. If it's a show, it should make its money from the person that bought a ticket and sat in the seat. And that really is a safety against all of those things when you think of it. You know, our operations is paid for by our ticket sales and bar and food sales. We that is unusual for an organization like us. That is my philosophy. I don't want to say, oh, well, now we have to cut all these shows because we lost a grant or we lost this funding. We've really made sure that the thing we're putting on the stage is something that people want to buy.
Tell me about your plans for this new education wing. What's going into this?
So we are, you know, we built the balcony in phase one and did a couple of other upgrades. Phase two is really focusing on the other side of the property. And we're going to be renovating the lobby and the bathrooms, as well as the upstairs, which is where we have educational studios and our dressing rooms and all that. And we're taking the building all the way out the back to it's going to be an addition all the way to the river, and it's going to wrap around the side of the river. And it's adding three education areas. One of them is a very large area. It's adding all these backstage areas, dressing rooms and things like that right off the stage so that people can get ready to go on for a show. I mean, right now people get ready upstairs and then they walk out onto the roof outside and down a set of stairs to get to our stage door. And it's, you know, it's a little journey. We've been doing that for 11 years. And so it's going to dramatically change the way it flows for anyone doing a show, whether it's kids or adults. And yeah, it's adding a significant amount of space. And in anticipation of that, we're actually redesigning our entire education program to incorporate. We have classes one night a week now during the school year, and then 4 weeks during the summer. And once we're built, the program we're building will be 3 to 4 days a week of education programs and 6 weeks during the summer.
Yeah, and you know, I think when people think about theater renovation, it's easy to forget about the importance of those backstage spaces, those tech spaces, into creating the show that you see on the stage.
Yeah, it's really important. You know, you have to have them. If you have a show, all of our kids shows, same thing with our full professional shows. They're changing costumes. They have to have a place to get ready, to do hair and makeup and all those things. You know, they have a place to go when scenery's changing and all of that kind of stuff. So the backstage area is really, really critical. And the Milton Theater was initially built as a movie theater. So there's no to little backstage area that's there currently. And you just kind of cram in there and, you know, do your best with that space. But this will add a lot of space for us to really significantly increase the quality and even the numbers of people involved with what's happening.
How can people get involved in the Capital campaign?
So if they go to the website, miltontheater.com, right on that, there's a donation link and they can donate. And we tell people every day, the amount of money doesn't matter. $5 makes as much of a difference as $500. We really need the community to come together on this, especially in light of the fact that we've had some of our funding pulled back. We're asking the community to jump in and help us meet this need. We've run at a lot of times of the year as our shows are sold out. And we keep wanting to add more and more shows as much as we can. But the children's program in particular, I personally feel that educating young people in the arts is life-changing. But the great thing about theater is it really, it removes the boundaries and it gives us a chance to really explore who we are and what we think of ourselves and what we think of the world around us and other people. And it's a place to kind of fearlessly go without having all these guide marks that you have to like be within. And I just feel that really shapes us as a human in a very unique way. And that's why I think it's great for anyone to study in the arts and why I'm asking people to give to our campaign so that we can offer more education to young people in Sussex County. It's needed. The demand is there. All the children that are on a wait list every year with us, it breaks my heart because I don't have the space or the ability to even allow them into the program. And this is going to open that up significantly for us.
Thanks to Milton Theater Director Fred Munzert and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. The Milton Theater is currently performing the Rocky Horror Show. Tickets and more information are available at miltontheater.com. And we close out the green next with Enlighten Me, where we learn how a Nemours neurologist's work could help develop therapies for autism, epilepsy, and Alzheimer's disease. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A Nemours neurologist receives a prestigious grant from the National Institutes of Health. The funding will be used to study brain patterns that could lead to shared therapies for autism, epilepsy, and Alzheimer's disease patients. The project will analyze patterns of dysfunction in the region of the brain that regulates memory and emotions, following research based on the theory that autism, epilepsy, and Alzheimer's may share the same faulty mechanism or disruption in the brain's neural networks. On this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry sits down with Nemours Children's Health Chief of Neurology, Dr. Rodney Scott, to discuss how his work can help patients.
Dr. Scott, you have received funding from the National Institutes of Health. How much did you get and how will it be used?
So we received $2.6 million to be used over 5 years. And the goal of the project that was funded is to try and find similar convergent abnormalities in brain networks that exist across a whole range of neurological disorders in a way that will allow us to intervene with brain stimulation strategies to try and improve learning and memory outcomes. Some of the money will be used for lab-based research, so a lot of that will be using animal models, but some of it is to build a computer version of a piece of the brain called the hippocampus, which will allow us to explore this particular idea much more broadly than we can in a lab environment. So overall, we want to be able to relate what's happening in the computer to what's happening in a brain. And by using an iterative process between those things, our goal is to improve learning and memory outcomes across the 1.6 million, no, the 6 million or so people in the United States with learning problems.
Now, the focus will be on autism, epilepsy, and Alzheimer's disease. Am I correct there?
That's correct, yeah.
How does that match up here with the project here with the research?
So the idea for all of those diseases is that there is an underlying cause, and the way to improve outcomes from those diseases is to treat the cause. This high risk, high reward program, which comes from the Office of the Director of the National Institutes of Health, is looking for paradigm changing ideas. So our big paradigm changing idea is that it's not fundamentally the cause. It's not the gene that caused autism or the brain injury that caused epilepsy or the amyloid deposition that causes Alzheimer's disease that's fundamentally the problem. The fundamental problem is the neural network, and that's the neural network that underpins learning and memory. And what we are showing is that if you stimulate the brain, you can recover the neural network without having to do anything at all to the underlying cause. That's the big novel idea here, which would lead to a complete change in the way that physicians ultimately go about treating these disorders.
You already mentioned that this is a high-risk, high-reward research, and the funding specifically was going towards that type of project. What makes it high-risk, high-reward?
It's high-risk because it might not work. So it's an idea, it's a hypothesis that we're going to be testing. The high reward is that there are a lot of people that have learning and memory impairments across a lot of diseases, which despite years of investment into projects that are trying to treat the underlying causes, we haven't made enormous amount of progress. So if this works, then the high reward is a completely different way of treating people, which hopefully will be more successful and more able to recover learning and memory problems than the current approaches.
We mentioned there's a connection between autism, epilepsy, and Alzheimer's disease already, but has there been research already that shows that there's already a connection here, that where this project comes in and it'll help treating them and maybe even defeating them, beating them?
So independently of each other, that's true. So one of the observations that we made prior to applying for this award is that when we look at how these neural networks are behaving across all of those models, we were struck by how similar the abnormalities were, despite there being very different diseases when they looked at individually. So there's a reasonable amount of work looking individually at neural networks and all of those things. The important step that we're taking is that overarching view that all of those diseases converge onto something similar and something that's targetable.
Going into this, when you come up with this project, is the goal you want attainable? I mean, is it something that you feel that you can, and this is in your professional opinion here, do you feel that it is attainable to reach the goal you're shooting for?
So I think it is attainable. The use of brain stimulation approaches is reasonably widespread now. So it's definitely used a lot in epilepsy. It's used in Parkinson's disease. So there are the idea that we can implant electrodes into a human brain and stimulate that brain to improve outcomes is already in clinical practice. That exists as an idea. So given that that platform exists, if we're able to show that there are particular types of stimulation in particular parts of the brain that have potentially could be improved to improve outcomes for a lot of people, it's not a big step to change where you put the wire and how you stimulate the brain in order to achieve those outcomes. So I think this is eminently feasible, and should the initial projects work, I think there's a very high chance that this would be translated into human populations reasonably quickly.
And is this something that I know the funding, it's a 5-year timeline. Is that something that it's attainable within that 5 years, or is this just maybe like a start to get you to a point where it can be defeated maybe within 10, 15 years? I mean, what are we looking at maybe? Again, another goal here for a timeline.
So the five years will take us to the point that we will know whether it's worth trying it out in humans or not. So that's the high risk piece. By the end of 5 years, we'll know one way or the other whether it's worth proceeding. I think if we get to the end of 5 years and it's working well and the idea is a solid one, my expectation is a string of subsequent studies in humans would take another 5 to 10 years before it became widely available, FDA approved, appropriate therapy.
As for going back to a timeline, you've secured the funding. What's next for you in this particular project?
So what's next is for us to do it. So we already are in the process of setting up all of the pipelines that we need for recording the neural networks, analyzing the neural networks, working out how to do the brain stimulation. We already have some work doing that type of thing, but we now need to do it specifically for this project. So we're in the process of doing that and in the process of making sure that the computer model is working well. I anticipate that that's going to take 3 to 6 months, and then we'll be ready to actually do the formal experiments, which take a long time. These are not short experiments. They take many months to perform, many months to analyze. So we're then in that process.
What would it mean to society if you are successful here in this project?
I think the obvious big hit is the Alzheimer's one. So there is a growing population of elderly people with Alzheimer's, an enormous economic cost to countries to be able to manage Alzheimer's disease and manage people that are dementing. So if it becomes possible to slow that down, to reverse that process, to change those trajectories, then the implications are huge. The ability to improve outcomes from Alzheimer's would be enormous. I'm a pediatric neurologist, so I have interests in autism, and it comes in flavors. There are many people with autism who are perfectly successful, who don't need this sort of intervention. But then there are people with very severe autism, severe learning problems, inability to integrate into society successfully. Again, major economic and health implications there. So if we can recover those sorts of impairments, then we have a big chance of maximizing quality of life for a reasonable chunk of society.
How important is that, where you could reach youngsters to the elderly here? I mean, that's a big range. And sometimes when you hear about stuff, it's just, oh, maybe it's just for this particular age group or that particular age group. This is going to affect the people of all ages.
So I hope that was part of the reason that the reviewers who looked at this application were enthusiastic about it. So these things get peer reviewed. We put in an application, it gets reviewed by a body of my peers, it then gets reviewed by the NIH. They have to be persuaded that there is a big idea inside here in order to get this particular type of funding. So I think we persuaded many people that this has potential to be successful. It's now our job to actually do the experiments and see whether it is successful.
And if you are successful, what would it mean for you both personally and professionally?
So personally, if there's a feather in my cap, I think I would be excited to be one of the team that achieved the thing that we were achieving. In terms of what it does for me personally, I think that's a personal thing. I'm excited by the science. I'm excited by doing the thing. I don't feel like I need any glory out the other end of that. If people get better and outcomes are improved, that will be enough for me.
Thanks to Nemours Children's Health Chief of Neurology, Dr. Rodney Scott, and our Joe Irizarry for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. just head to the Greens page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Contributor John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Joey Erzarin, Abigail Lee, and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.